2004 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 371, What's Behind the Da Vinci Code Craze? Uncovering the Divine Feminine. A panel featuring Margaret M. Toscano, Paul Toscano, Janice Allred, and Jody England Hansen.
The title of our panel is What's Behind the Da Vinci Code Craze? Uncovering the Divine Feminine. This particular session is sponsored by the Mormon Women's Forum, which is a Mormon feminist group. And just as a quick little announcement, every fall, usually at the end of October or beginning of November, we have what is called the Counterpoint Conference. And we're actually organized this year, and we have an announcement about the conference, which gives our overall topic is called Women's Place in the Mormon Church, Tackling the Tough Issues. We're going to have four panels, one on the Proclamation on the Family, whether that makes women in the church second-class citizens, one on women in priesthood, one on issues called Why Aren't We Angry? Issues of Repression, Power, and Equality, and the final one on the Disappearance of the Heavenly Mother. So those are all the tough issues, right? Anyway, we're calling for participation. Also, if you're interested in being on our mailing list so that you get further information, we always have it at the University of Utah. It's on a Saturday. So I'm going to put these bright pink things if we want to. You want to pass them around or just put them up here? November 6th is the actual date. I will put the pink flyers up here. Make sure you get them after the session. And we'd love to have people contact us about participating. Well, let's begin. I want to welcome you to yet another session on the Da Vinci Code. The famous book by Dan Brown that everyone's talking about. When it's the bestseller in Costco, you know that America is reading. And every time I've traveled on the airplane in the last few couple of months, everybody, there's at least one person on the plane reading the Da Vinci Code, right? I was also talking to my neighbor this morning who told me that he and his daughter wanted to read the Da Vinci Code, but they didn't want to buy the book, even at Costco. So they went to the public library and found out that the Salt Lake County owns 400 copies of the Da Vinci Code and that there were 400 holds that they had to wait for before their name came up, which it eventually did, and they both had read it. So that gives you a little indication. Our panelists today are myself, Margaret Toscano, Janice Allred to my left, Jody England Hansen, and Paul Toscano, my husband. We have so much to talk about, I'm not going to give any introductions. I could say we need no introductions, but you know, that doesn't sound very good. So we're going to dispense with that. You can read the silly little things they have on the Sunstone program. So hopefully what we want to do today, there's been a lot of talk at Sunstone this year on this book, and what we would like to do is carry this into a different direction that, in fact, I thought everybody was going to do, but nobody has yet. And so our fresh perspective, fresh but obvious for a session for the Sunstone Symposium, is that we're going to do the Mormon connection that no one has talked about yet. So here what we're going to do is we're going to talk about some of the theological implications of Dan Brown's book from a Mormon perspective. Now, I think it's interesting that Dan Brown's book is probably not as shocking to most Mormons as it is to most Catholics and Protestants, especially evangelicals. Because Mormons are accustomed to believing in ideas that Orthodox Christians find unorthodox. Or if Mormons don't actually believe these ideas, they at least are subconsciously more tolerant of certain heterodox and taboo theological concepts like the divine feminine and the possibility of Jesus being married. I just don't think these are as shocking to Mormons as they are to evangelical Christians, even if we don't talk about those regularly in Sunday school. And that sort of interesting paradox is one of the things we want to talk about. This is probably due to notions that a lot of our doctrines, that even if we don't talk about Jesus being married and the Heavenly Mother very much in Sunday school, or maybe never at all, we do talk about things like eternal marriage. We talk about the idea of eternal sexual identity, eternal procreation, the idea that we as humans may become gods and goddesses ourselves. And all of these are referenced in Mormon texts. So I don't think that the book is as shocking to Mormons. So these Mormon ideas may soften the blow for Latter-day Saints of some of the theological possibilities in Dan Brown's book. Now, let me just quickly give you the format for our session today. We're going to have basically three parts to our discussion. First of all, each of the panelists is going to give a short little presentation. They promised me they're all going to be short. We'll start, in fact, with Paul. Then we'll go to Jody, Janice, and I'm going to end. Then after, we don't want to do that more than 20 minutes, panelists. And then second, we're going to do a roundtable discussion where we have about four questions that we're going to sit around the table. We're going to take the mic over there and talk over some questions in a roundtable fashion. And then finally, I wanted to leave at least 30 minutes open for the audience. I don't think the audience has had enough time to really interact on this. To interact with us, where that you can give your comments and questions, and hopefully we might even get into a nice, friendly debate. So that's what I see as our format. So, Paul, why don't we begin with your statement? What I did is I asked each of them to give sort of an overall reaction to the book.
I understand that Clifton Jolly is around here also in a white suit. The difference between our suits is that mine is comprised of a great deal more material. There is some KFC outside. I brought it with me. Though I enjoyed the Da Vinci Code when I read it, upon reflection I felt that its principal weakness is its principal strength, the intertwining and therefore confusion of murder mystery with religious mystery. These two mysteries are very different. A murder mystery can be solved and explained, not always, but usually. A religious mystery can only be experienced. If we accept the assertion that religious mystery is an encoded message that can be decoded, or an encrypted text that can be decrypted, then we will, I believe, be disappointed in the final revelation. Or else we will be left to accept as the ultimate one and only true, whatever that is, a single perspective that will be inadequate, untenable, idiosyncratic, and false. Religious mystery is not a hidden answer. It is the reality that lies beyond perception and interpretation. It is not something we can possess, but something that calls us out of the narrow prisons of our limited language, our opacity of mind, our egocentricity. Religious mystery is the dark matter of the spiritual world, something we cannot see, but come to accept as essential to the fabric of reality. If, for us, spirituality is not a mystery, but the Mormon Church, or the Catholic Church, or the Protestant way, or Judaism, or Islam, or secularism, or the Enlightenment, or positivism, or technology, then we are doomed to see all things in the twilight of our contracted preferences. In that dimness, we will inevitably come to accept many foolish ideas as wise, and many false ideas as true. We will come to believe that we can command others in the name of God, that we are worthy because we are religious, that we are lovable because we are loved, that we are competent because we are called, that we are right because we have might, that we are righteous because we are rich. We will come to believe that we are devout when we are only insular, that we are determined when we are only stubborn, that we are prudent when we are only afraid, that we are strong when we are only brutish, that we are loyal when we are only servile, that we are united when we are only obsequious, that we are holy when we are only proud. Those who believe in the one and only true church, or way, or political party, cannot usually be persuaded by reason or evidence or even by experience, spiritual or otherwise, unless perhaps sometimes by personal catastrophe that reveals the vision as fantasy, the order as slavery, the righteousness as an iniquitous rejection of freedom and grace. Religious mystery is without closure. It is an open estuary to a living and boundless sea of contradictions, puzzles, ironies, paradoxes, and anomalies. Monological religion, on the other hand, whether fabricated by the Priory of Zion or the Quorum of the Twelve, whether encoded into the Art of Leonardo or inscribed in the curriculum of the church education system, is a dead sea of prejudice, denial, narrow-mindedness, and fear. Whether by advertence or inadvertence, Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code taps into our understandable but immature lust for the one and only true answer to everything. But there is no such answer, either encrypted or in plain text. There are only inadequate descriptions, scientific and otherwise, of an endless array of phenomena, of a strange and layered universe, where macrocosm and microcosm, interiority and exteriority, passion and calculation, consciousness and unconsciousness, maddeningly race, above, beneath, and beyond the venue of our understanding. Religious mystery is not something you can get into a book.
I brought visual aids. I have spoken with a lot of people about the Da Vinci Code long before I read it. I finally got around to reading it in April, and because enough people had said, I want to know what you think of it. And what I realize is there's good news and there's good news. And the good news is, if it upsets you, relax. It's just a novel. If it awakens you, this is really great. It's a novel. Now we know how to talk about forbidden subjects. We just make it look like fiction. And so it's good news all around. How I came to be on the panel is I proposed a paper for the forum, and the title of the paper is The Da Vinci Code Controversy, ? Sometimes a triangle is just a triangle. I really enjoyed The Da Vinci Code. It's a great read. It's not great literature, classic literature. It's a real page-turner. But there were all these glitches in my enjoyment. I have a lot of background in art, and there are glaring mistakes around descriptions of art. I don't care what he says in the front about being accurate in descriptions of art. He's way off. And so that, you know, was kind of, okay, just it's fine if he's going to describe it that way. But every line meant something. Every triangle or golden mean proportion was a subversive reference to the divine feminine. And just as an example, you know, with my background as an artist, there are some things that are visually pleasing. And the only reason an artist uses those elements is because they are visually pleasing. I'm a book artist. I make one-of-a-kind books. And one aspect of book arts is altered books, where you take an existing book and you create a piece of art out of it. I also collect nativities. I focus on handmade nativities and symbolic nativities. And I made this for my mother. It's an altered book nativity. And I made it before I read Da Vinci Code. And it has, on the outside, collaged different classic master paintings of events of the the nativity, the leading up to the nativity, times after the nativity. This book was actually a Reader's Digest condensed novel that I liked the titles of, because in the titles, two of the titles that jumped out at me was The Covenant and Hope, A Lost Survived. So I actually used those titles as part of what was being expressed. And inside is a symbolic nativity. There are just items that represent the Joseph, the Mary, the opposites. I have a way of lettering in my books that's called deconstruction, where I do the calligraphy, but I shift the strokes around. So it is not legible, but it's visual. It doesn't mean that what I'm writing in here is secret. It just means that I don't want the words to get in the way of the visual. So here's something that someone could look at and go, this is so subversive. It's got to be controversial. And all it is an expression of an artist. And so I bring it as an example. You know, there's the five-petal red carnation representing Mary. And so a lot of the things are there because they're there. And so I think a lot of the times we try to find meaning in things that are just there. But a great thing about the novel is that, well, let me get back to the approach around the nativity. I love the nativity story. It's a powerful story, and it invites each of us to be a part of bringing Christ into the world. And so I choose to portray it in many ways, symbolically as well as literally. And this is very applicable to Mormons as a culture. It invites us to step into the nativity story and be a part of bringing Christ into the world. My favorite part of the novel is Margaret Starbird's contribution to it. Every source that I use from Margaret Starbird is really what captivated me. And this tradition of the sacred anointing, the divine union, it is so much a part of our tradition. And as Margaret said, this is not a surprise. There are several couples that all my life have kind of suggested this divine union. It's been part of a conversation almost my whole life. And Jesus and Mary, it's not the only one. There's Joseph and Mary, and there's Adam and Eve. And so we have these examples in our history of these sacred unions that we are called to look to as sacred unions, not just people who happen to be a part of history, but what it is that they represent for us and what they call us to be. So first, I just want to touch on my search for the divine feminine. Mother in Heaven, too, has been acknowledged most of my life, and I saw my dad actively search for her and gain enlightenment. I saw his expression and awareness of her change over the years, and so I felt very comfortable doing the same. If I was not sure of how much I knew about her or where she was, then I felt free to go and look. So one time I decided I was going to read the scriptures specifically looking for her. And this was not an open and see what the scriptures fall open to. It was read the scriptures straight through looking for her. And there was a scripture, and it's on this handout as well, that really jumped out at me. It's in 2 Nephi chapter 7. It's the first verse, and it says, "Yea, for thus saith the Lord, have I put thee away, or have I cast thee off forever? For thus saith the Lord, where is the bill of your mother's divorcement? To whom have I put thee away, or to which of my creditors have I sold you? Yea, to whom have I sold you? Behold, your iniquities have ye sold yourselves, and for your transgressions is your mother put away." And what really was inspiring to me about this is, if I couldn't see Mother in Heaven, it was because of me. And if I wanted to see her, it was because of me. No one else was hiding her or taking her from me. So again, it goes back to, if you will have eyes to see, you will see. And all of a sudden I could see, she is everywhere. And before this is about 15 years ago that I really saw this scripture in a new way. And before this time, the evidence of her is in the very clear description of how we were created. We were created in God's image, male and female. And what occurred to me is everywhere God is mentioned, it's male and female. It's our heavenly parents. No one's hiding anywhere, and no one is lost. Heavenly Mother definitely knows where she is. She's not lost. We're the ones who aren't seeing her, we as a people. And so it's really up to us to see her. So when I opened my eyes, there she was. She was everywhere, and I didn't have to hunt anymore. Then I really found out the absolute worst way at all to share this enlightenment. I spent years telling others about it in a very ineffective way. So I'm going to tell you what didn't work for me. It might work for you, but it doesn't. It did not work for me. I always had an agenda. So whenever I was talking about Mother in Heaven, it was to make sure people agreed. It was to make sure that they saw that if they didn't see her, they were wrong. If they didn't appreciate her role and her constant presence, then they were really dense. And it didn't work. And people started just closing off to me. They didn't want to hear anything about it. And I can understand why. I don't think anyone wants to be told that they're wrong. And I shut down if someone is challenging me that way. So in the last few years, I've learned to share when it comes up. I learned to share it as something that I would share that's good. And there's nothing behind my sharing. I'm not sharing so that I'm trying to convert anyone or convince anyone. I'm just sharing. And it's amazing the cross-section, the variety of people who want to engage in that kind of a conversation. And they are not threatened. I have talked, had very open discussions about Mother in Heaven and women's role with people who are extremely conservative in their background, and they feel very open and free to talk about it. Oh, okay. Just to close really quickly. So that's the Divine Feminine, but as a closing statement, I think the real point of this is that it leads towards the union, the divine union. And one thing that I saw recently is in almost the entire 20 years that I've been married to my husband, I have been competing with him. It was a partnership of seeing who had suffered more or worked harder or needed more or whatever, and we were deeply in love with each other, but it was always a contest. And recently, thanks to some incredible communication courses, we've made a quantum leap in really having no competition there and total partnership, so that we are so much more when we are accepting and acknowledging each other right then for exactly who we are. And that divine union is the example that we can follow with the couples that we have to look for, especially the Adam and Eve story. And I think that's what Eros Gamos is about. I could go into details about the elevation of what the partnership becomes, but my eyes would dilate and my children would blush. And I just want to say that when you can give up trying to one-up each other and trying to see who should be or might be or needs to be, then something happens in your partnership that takes it to a sacred level and glimpses Godhood, so that it's the only thing you want to head towards. And I think that's the great message that can come across or lead us to in what's happening in this culture.
Like so many other readers, I found the Da Vinci Code an engrossing mystery. I found it hard to put down as it introduced and then intertwined mystery after mystery. The quest of Robert and Sophie seemed of profound importance. I love word puzzles, and symbols, Christianity, and the divine feminine are subjects of great importance to me. But finally, I was disappointed. Perhaps I expect too much. Although the Da Vinci Code affirms the importance of the divine feminine, the theology it advances is seriously flawed. Of course, Dan Brown's purpose is not to develop a theology of the divine feminine, but the novel does promise to reveal secrets about the divine feminine. It presents a revised view of the origins of Christianity, which it connects with the suppression of the knowledge of the divine feminine. The uncovering of this plot is one of the driving motives of the novel. The reader is drawn into the story with the promise of uncovering important knowledge of the divine feminine. But Brown does not deliver on this promise. The theology of the Da Vinci Code is taught by Teabing. Although he is finally revealed as an unsympathetic character, his version of early Christianity is what the book affirms. I will briefly discuss some of the ideas he asserts and how they relate to a theology of the divine feminine. The first is that until the Council of Nicaea, Jesus was viewed by his followers as a mortal prophet. This is simply not true. The writings that became the New Testament were mostly written in the first century AD, with a few being written in the first part of the second century, while the Council of Nicaea was held in the fourth century. One of the most serious questions it considered was the relationship of Christ's humanity to his divinity, but this was certainly not a new question. This was a theological question that arose from the church's teachings about the life and death of Jesus and its meaning for humanity. The letters of Paul to the churches and the letter to the Hebrews show clearly that the early Christian church worshipped Christ as Lord. The Gospels, especially the Gospel of John, reveal the divinity of Jesus, but they also affirm his humanity. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. The Creator of the universe was born as a human baby. He grew up in a family, got hungry, ate, slept, wept, bled, and died. Teabing claims that the church outlawed, gathered up, and burned the Gospels that emphasized his humanity and canonized the ones that affirmed his divinity. This is a strange assertion because the texts that he cites as being among those suppressed are those that were found at Nag Hammadi. These Gnostic writings are mythical rather than historical. The Gospels of the New Testament are presented as history. Written with a purpose, but history nonetheless, history with names of real places and people who were witnesses of the events recounted. The Gnostic texts, for the most part, do not focus on the words and deeds of the human Jesus. They use him as a character to reveal certain teachings, but the conversations and settings are not presented as actual events. Teabing claims that the Catholic Church promoted the divinity of Christ in order to solidify its power base. He claims that the knowledge of his marriage to Mary Magdalene would nullify the claim that he was divine. But the Orthodox Christian teaching is that Jesus is both human and divine. The Word became flesh. The question of whether or not Jesus was married bears much more on the meaning of sexuality than Jesus's humanity. The actual teachings, parables, and actions of Jesus promote a radical egalitarianism. If God, the creator of the universe, makes himself equal to us, never uses coercive power, teaches that the greatest is the servant of all, and lives a life of service, doesn't that undo authoritarianism? Mary Magdalene, according to the Gospels, was the first witness to the resurrection. That was what gave her the position of the apostle to the apostles. But if Jesus was not resurrected, what was her message? Teabing claims that she was a threat to the early church leaders because Jesus chose her to lead the church. But what was the message of the church to be? What was its purpose? If there was no salvation from sin and death through Christ, what was the meaning of the church? If Jesus was not divine, then why would the wife of Jesus have any special significance? And isn't there a problem with considering her important because she was his wife? Teabing says, the Priory of Sion to this day worships Mary Magdalene as the goddess, the Holy Grail, the Rose, and the Divine Mother. Why? If the Divine Feminine is a mythic concept or transcendental power, then any woman might function as an embodiment of that archetype. Although there is some variation in Gnostic teachings, they tend to denigrate the physical and the historical. Some Gnostic texts teach that this world is evil, created by an evil God. If the flesh, the physical, is denigrated, then woman is denigrated, for it is she who gives birth to the physical body. If the flesh is called evil, then a complementary duality of masculine and feminine is impossible. I believe that the feminine principle is a fundamental part of reality that both men, women and men should seek to understand and embody. But for me, this is not enough. I believe that Jesus Christ is the eternal Father, that God himself came down to redeem his people. And because the gospel of Christ is a gospel of equality, being addressed to men and women as equals, I believe that there is also an eternal mother who is a personal being with real existence. I believe that she is not simply the wife of God the Father, but that she plays an active role in the creation, redemption, and sanctification of her children and the creation of Zion. And I am seeking further light and knowledge.
I had a little statement that I was going to read, but in light of time, because I want to have a lot of discussion time, I'm going to summarize some of my remarks and lead these into what I want us to be our first discussion question. Janice has already raised some of the questions that I had in my remarks, and this has to do with the relationship between history and metaphor. So I thought for us to discuss the question of the historical versus metaphorical question in the book, that I would just quickly go over six points that are in the novel that are perhaps the six major points that people argue over as to whether or not these are historically accurate. And as Janice implied, one of the really key questions of the book is the question of what do we consider historical and what do we consider fact? The other day, the panel, if any of you were there, when Margaret Starbird and Maxine Hanks and Lance Owens were talking about this book, all three of them emphasized the importance of the metaphorical, which I totally concur with. In fact, I suppose that one of the things I've tried to do in my own theological writings is to encourage Mormons to be more metaphorical and symbolic in their approach to theology. I think it's really interesting that we as Mormons tend to be very pragmatic in our approach to religion. We tend to be literalistic in our reading of the scriptures. We tend to want to emphasize everyday practical lessons versus kind of inner spiritual mystical truths. And perhaps one of the reasons that I had a hard time fitting into Mormonism is that I tend to be more of the mystic than the pragmatist. And I always like the mystical readings of things. And I certainly think that for anyone who's interested in inner spirituality, that you have to look at things from a metaphorical point of view. Nevertheless, I think that it's not just Mormons, but Christians in general, the question of the historicity of the story of Jesus is very crucial. And so I want to briefly say, well, you know, as a scholar, in terms of some of the things that Dan Brown puts forth as historical, you know, where is he somewhat accurate, where is he completely off, and where is there a question mark? Now, as a preface to this very brief little summary, I think it's important to note that if you are in fact a good scholar, you don't see facts as absolute. That there's always a place where interpretation, contextualization, and so forth come in. And so, for example, with the question of the divinity of Jesus, you can't prove historically whether Jesus was divine. I mean, this is just not a question that you can prove historically. However, you can pretty well establish when certain people in the Christian church believed that Jesus was divine. And I agree with Janice, the outline that she gave, that I think there's pretty good evidence from the texts of the New Testament, which most and all reputable scholars date as, you know, beginning in maybe earliest with Paul in about the 50s into the first part of the second century, that there is a lot of evidence that the early Christians saw Jesus as divine. So that's question number one. The second question, which is maybe one of the most controversial, was Jesus married? I think that this is one of those questions that scholars will say, the problem here is we have really no evidence pro or con. Now, the tradition of the church, of course, is the Catholic Church, is that he was not. Those that argue that he was use arguments more from cultural context. They say, for example, and Margaret Starbird used this the other day, that it was a tradition in Jewish culture that all adult men, there was a strong urgency to be married. And that, for example, if you were a rabbi, there was a requirement. And so if you look at the cultural context, this could be a good reason for arguing that Jesus was married. Is that absolute proof? No. Other arguments that are used is the importance of Mary in the Gospels and the fact that, again, according to the context of Jewish culture, because they had so much a separation of the genders and sexes, that kind of close contact between Jesus and Mary could imply that maybe there was a more intimate relationship. Then, of course, there are the Gnostic Gospels, which are dated more toward the end of the 2nd century, and there's more evidence that maybe there was a marriage relationship. There are some of these Gospels in the Gnostic texts that talk about Mary being the companion of Jesus and being intimate with him. But again, most scholars will say we really do not have enough evidence to absolutely say yay or nay. And although in the past, and I've actually been interested in this question for about the last 25 years, and all of a sudden my mind's gone blank, there was a book that came out in the 1970s by a Protestant. Do you remember his name, Janice?
Phipps,
yes. Was Jesus married? And he asserts that he was. He gets all of this evidence together, and I think that he gives some good evidence. Recently, I saw a program where they interviewed a very top-notch scholar, and of course, again, I didn't write his name down, but he's a Catholic father at Notre Dame, very good scholar. Was it O'Brien? I just knew Vern could have all the facts for us. Thanks, Vern. But O'Brien, who says, I'm not at all troubled with the idea that Jesus was married. It doesn't affect my religious feelings at all. He says, I really can't say one way or the other, but I kind of tend to think maybe not, but you really can't say. One other argument for Jesus being married is they say, well, because it was unusual for Jews not to be married, they might have mentioned it. But of course, there were patterns. There were the Essenes that did have, and others that took vows of celibacy. So really, basically, from a scholarly point of view, the question of Jesus being married is very open. Second question, actually third, we did divinity, Jesus being married. Third one, what was the place of Mary Magdalene in early Christianity? Now here, I find that most scholars will say that we can make a much stronger assertion about Mary Magdalene being a very crucial player in early Christianity than we can about whether Jesus was married. That both, because you have both, not only in the Gnostic text, but in the New Testament itself, the centrality of the women. And there is a lot of scholarship, very good biblical scholarship, that argues that before you had the institutionalizing of the Christian church, that women had leadership roles in the church. And we don't have time to go through all the evidence, but I think that's very significant. And in fact, a scholar like Elaine Pagels, who's a very high, Gnostic scholar on Gnosticism, she says, well, I'm not sure about the Jesus being married thing, but I am very certain that Mary Magdalene and other women were very important in leadership roles in the early church. Next question, which is more the art historian question, which is about Leonardo, and was he really painting Mary Magdalene into the painting of the Last Supper? Here, and again, this same special, there's only really one art historian that seems to have any credibility that says, absolutely, I think it was Mary Magdalene. Most art historians are going to say, no, if you look at the overall tradition of painting the Last Supper and other religious themes that John the Beloved Apostle was always painted as young and effeminate. That is part of the painting tradition. And next to Jesus. And so most art historians will say, no, you can't really prove that. However, I want to make one point here, which I think is going to help lead us into this discussion. I agree with you, Jody, that a triangle is sometimes a triangle. But I think also art, just like any kind of human production, is complex, and that there are always multiple levels of interpretation. And I really reject the idea as a scholar of art and literature and all of these things that I love to teach about, of acting as though there's one interpretation and that there are never hidden levels of meaning. That even if the artist didn't put the hidden levels in there, I think there can sometimes be those that come in the unconscious. And so for me, maybe, and this gets to my sort of final point before I turn this over to the rest of the panel, I do not like any kind of history that says there's one interpretation. I don't see facts in that way. I see them as much more open. Finally, the last point I want to make about historical things, what about the idea of the Holy Grail, being a woman, Jesus having a child? Is there any historical proof to this? In terms of early Christian documents, I don't think there are any. This is a legend that comes from the late Middle Ages. Now, did it come down through history and secret channels? We don't know. I personally like the idea, but historically it's not something that I think we can prove. So I want to now turn to the panel and ask this question. Does it matter what is historically accurate or inaccurate in Dan Brown's book? How much does this matter in terms of our response to it and what we're going to do with some of the theological issues? So does one of you want to answer?
Or shall we just let everybody? I think we should have all of you respond.
Oh, okay. This is a really interesting question, and I think that there are levels here again that you can respond to it. You can say this is just fiction, so what does it matter? He can make up whatever he wants to. But as readers, we all know that there are conventions. In historical fiction, a good historical fiction writer does a lot of research and tries to make the history as accurate as possible. As a reader, this is what you expect from a novel that's historical fiction. In science fiction, you expect that although there might be some innovative thinking, that there's going to be some things that are real science. You've got to have some way to hold it together. So I think even when we're in a murder mystery, that we are going to expect that some things are going to be historically accurate. And on questions such as, was Jesus married, I think it's perfectly right and responsible for Dan Brown to say there's no evidence, either conclusive evidence either way. So as a novelist, I am going to take the premise that he was married, and then we will see what develops from that premise. I think that's fine. But I think for him to, like I said in my introduction here, for him to say that the Catholic Church in 325 A.D. decided to make Jesus divine as a way to establish their power, I think that's extremely irresponsible, and I think he's breaking the trust that we have in him as a novelist.
Ditto. And I think along those lines, this is what Dan Brown does a really good job of. He gives us enough information where he brings us in so that we think that we're on top of it. And that's really great. And I think it's why his novels are very captivating. He leads us to feel like we're in on this half-secret, half-history representation. And I think he does that really well. People who know, I come, like I said, more from an art history background, and I'm sorry if you thought I was
in a history. I don't hold a writer's feet to the fire in the way some of the other panelists do. I don't know why they do, but they do. It's kind of like, I don't know why they do, but I don't. I like the book on that level because I felt that even if it were not historically accurate, it was spiritually true. It may be that the Catholic, that Constantine didn't establish for the first time the divinity of Jesus, but he did make Christianity the state religion, and he did basically change the nature of the of Christianity. It created, essentially, at that time, the Nicene Creed created the Catholic Church in its first incarnation, I think, as a global religion. Maybe not global in the sense that we think of it, but it was the Roman world. And I think that he started it on the path to being the authoritarian, anti-progressive, narrow-minded institution that we all know and love today. And as a model for many other institutions of Christianity that came after. Now, you may be shocked at this statement and think, my God, the resonance of Bruce R. McConkie as the Catholic Church being the Church of the Devil. I don't think the Catholic Church is the Church of the Devil, but I think it has, you know, it persecuted Galileo, it doesn't like evidence, it hides molesting priests, it moves them around. It's like any other corporation that really is self-serving. And it's robed in this kind of religious stuff, you know. So I think when Dan Brown starts to hammer on the Catholic Church a bit about what it has in its archives and its secretiveness and its basically not being accountable to anybody, even though he may get the specific facts wrong about that, I think he's correct. generally speaking. I mean, it's, you know, they may not have persecuted dissectors in the time of Leonardo, but they persecuted somebody in the time of Leonardo. And it may have been lazy on Dan Brown's part to basically, you know, link the dissection to the persecution because maybe that didn't happen. But believe me, they were persecuting somebody because we all know that. And so I think, you know, that's how you have to look at a novel. It's not an history. And so though I disagree in some respects, I think that Dan Brown was more or less truthful about some of the problems that he was talking about. I think he was wrong in trying to, like I said earlier, have some answer or specific knowledge or gnosis or something hidden in a chalice protected by a blade in the Louvre of all places underneath the glass pyramid. I mean, I think that is a construct that I think also that we could pick at, but I can understand. But you never find out what it is. They never open it up. I mean, you never get to the thing. And so I think maybe to his credit, he leaves the mystery more or less as a mystery and risks being kind of an unsatisfying mystery writer. But I think he was spiritually true to the idea that we never get to know what the mystery is either.
I want to move now to the question of Jesus being married. And those of you who are Mormon historians know that this was something that was taught in the 19th century in Mormonism, and that, in fact, a lot of the Mormon leaders felt that they were descendants of Jesus. And, of course, this was not Mormons alone. I mean, the whole idea of the British Israel is an old notion. You have not only the idea of the Merovingian kings, but there are, as part of the Arthurian legend, the idea that there's this British Israel. So a couple of questions for the panel. On the one hand, I think that it shouldn't bother, I think most Mormons are not bothered with the idea that Jesus was married, and yet it's not something we talk about. And that is curious to me. And I wonder why. I wonder, for example, if you think of Mormonism had this chance to be on the vanguard of the divine feminine, both in the sense of Jesus being married and the idea of the legitimacy of this notion and the idea of the divine feminine, but we haven't been. And, you know, why have we been afraid to talk about that as Mormons? It just seems so natural for me to believe it. I do have to add one little tidbit here that a friend of mine years ago, this again probably was 20, 25 years ago, I don't like to think about how long things were ago now, but he started into, you know, looking at Mormon history, and he found out the idea that this was taught in the 19th century, and this was back in the days of Mark Peterson. And somehow he got an appointment with Mark Peterson. He was a BYU student, and maybe Brother Peterson thought he could kind of help him in some way. So he went up and said, you know, do you believe that Jesus was married? And Mark Peterson said, well, I know that was taught, he said, but I think Jesus was above all of that. And to me, I mean, this is such a startling answer for a Mormon to make. And actually, I would like us to kind of connect this. I think we should talk about sex here. You know, I mean, is there, was Mark Peterson hung up about sex somehow?
Not at all.
We don't want to get into that. But, you know, why have we been afraid to propose this, to talk about it? Do we want to go in reverse order?
Let's go in reverse.
Well, I think the reason why this is true, I mean, in the early days of the church, we had polygamy. Polygamy was then a radical form of marriage. It was not a reactionary thing that it is today. And those are very different ideas. When polygamy was introduced in the church, it was a radical restructuring. It was what it intended to be. And it was polygamy. It wasn't just polygyny. There's a lot of evidence that there was that some of the women in the Mauvoo were married to more than one man at the same time in Joseph Smith's time. This was kind of narrowed in Brigham Young's time to polygyny, as we later came to understand it. But sex has always been a very difficult thing, not just for Mormonism because of its quirky past on these issues. But the Christian church, I think most of the religions, have a problem with this. And I think the reason why is because of the need. The need that human beings have for sex is very difficult for religions to deal with. And it's certainly much more difficult to project this into the divine, to think that God is a male and there's a God, the female, and that they have a need for each other. I mean, the idea that God has needs, that God isn't just simply transcendent and totally other and entirely in control of everything. I mean, the idea that we are more like God and God is more like us than orthodoxy teaches is extremely troubling, because it means that we can't look to God as an absolute. And this is frightening for people who want to think of the universe as simply in the control of a person who loves them and is going to make everything work out for them. And I think this is the root cause. It's the sense that, no, I don't want Jesus to be married. I don't want him wanting Mary Magdalene. I don't want him groping in the night. I don't want him having to clean himself off afterwards. And I don't want him to have to explain to her where he was. I want him concentrating on saving me. He needs to be saving me. What's he doing? He's interested in something other than me. It's just nonsensical that we have this view that we are that important, that he is going to give up an ordinary experience of human life so that we can have the feeling that he's just always thinking about us.
That's great. I think it really is along the same line. It's a very difficult, I don't know if it's cultural, I don't know if it's just part of being human, but there is this difficult thing about us to relate to something that can be so amazing as something, you know, that at the same time we struggle with. We really do struggle with it. And you know, I cut my remarks short along this, but it has so much to do with truly celebrating a partnership as opposed to groping in the night. And either way, it's going to happen. Either way, it's going to happen. As human beings, this is what we want. This is what we do. Now, what it...
Groping for the union.
Both. And the thing, you know, the thing that's really amazing is to transition from seeing it as an obligation, something that we as human beings have to do, that we have a duty to do so that we can multiply, you know, separating that out and seeing it as this amazing hallmark of the gods, expression of partnership and love and appreciation and acknowledgement is something that I think is very possible in this life, definitely an amazing experience in this life, and yet it is something that we almost have to overcome whatever we've got in the past, our culture, ideas about being wrong or having to be good enough or performance or whatever it is we've got around this, you know, the situation of the actual act of sex as well as femaleness and maleness. Every society seems to be battling this out, male versus female. Well, if you can't see some kind of, you know, bonding that's beneficial and wonderful and amazing, how can sex achieve that kind of level of amazement? It's just kind of trying to overcome this conflict that you've got for a few minutes. And so I think that's something that the Eros Gamos can really, you know, look towards creating in humanity, is that we don't see it as just overcoming our conflicts long enough to have a satisfying moment, but to really see it as this expression of an ongoing partnership that is really an incredible experience. And,
I want to take back what I said.
What do you want to take back?
I want to take back what I said about Jesus groping. Because I just realized, since he created the clitoris, he probably could find it without groping.
However, Paul, there is the veil. It has been interesting to me to think about this question, because some of the earliest Mormon doctrine that we have affirms not only the goodness of human sexuality, but sexuality as an eternal principle. We are taught that we are literally children of God, and we use the word literal. This is not metaphorical. God the Father and God the Mother had sex of some sort, and then we
still do.
And still do, right? And then we are the fruit of this union. And that is affirmed. And then there is also the teaching, which I think has been largely forgotten in the church, that God the Father and Mary, the mother of Jesus, had sex in order to produce Jesus. This, in fact, is a teaching about why Jesus is divine. I happen to disagree with this doctrine, but this is a doctrine that the church has had. And in fact, I had to support my idea that this idea has been lost. Shortly after the first court, my story was in the newspaper, and they said that I believe that Jesus is God the Father, which I do. But then I was in an automobile accident, and there was this policeman who had to drive me home because my car was wrecked. So he was questioning me about my theology. It was a very interesting experience. So he said, "Well, and I don't remember how the argument went. I wish I could, but he said, finally I asked him, well, who do you think is the father of Jesus Christ in the flesh? He said, well, Joseph. You know, Joseph and Mary, you know, anybody knows that. That's what he really believed. So that surprised me. So we do have this ambivalence, even though we have these doctrines that affirm the eternal nature of sexuality.
You know, I think one of the hardest questions in religion is how you bring together sexuality and spirituality. And, I mean, I forced Paul to be on this panel. He only did it because he's married to me and wanted to get along. But, you know, I'm glad for your irreverence, if you want to call it that in a way, Paul. But I think it's interesting that we think of that as irreverent. You know, is it only, is sex only spiritual if we don't say any certain words and we kind of, you know, talk about it in certain ways? You know, I think it's a huge conflict in culture, and not just in Mormonism, but in every religion, the way in which we bring together our spiritual selves and our sexual selves, I think it's one of the most dysfunctional areas of human culture. And if there is, you know, if you're thinking of the Eros Gamos as a symbol of union, I mean, I think that one thing we need, and I'm not sure I have the answers as to how we do it, but I think we have to use everything, including your irreverence, Paul, which I like, to try to work through this problem, because it's a huge problem in our culture, and we don't like to talk about how big of a problem it is, how dysfunctional we are in this area.
When I joined Mormonism, I was quite young. I was like, I contacted it at the age of 16, and the first things I heard about were these things, these very things. God has a body, God has a wife, she's a goddess, the reproduction, it goes on forever. I wasn't so much sex obsessed, unfortunately, I wish I now were, as a young man. But I was obsessed with the idea of that life on earth would be irrelevant if there weren't a continuation of embodiment hereafter, because what's the point of all of this if we're going to just become either nothing or just transcend all of this? It makes no sense to me. It has to be something. So I was captivated by these ideas. And my first experience with real theology came at BYU not very long after, with Hiram Andrus, who was a wonderful teacher of theology and who never gets any credit for some of the ideas that get bandied about these days. But he was very adamant about the idea of the balance between the physical and the spiritual, and how, and these secret things in Mormonism, that Jesus was married, that there was a lineage that came down, that the Joseph Smith and Brigham Young were all descendants of Jesus Christ, and so were the early apostles, and I think some of them still think that today, and all of that. But this was very vital to me, and when I was excommunicated, at the same time the church was trying to throw off these things. I mean, what attracted me to Mormonism is the very thing that now the leaders of the church are embarrassed about. And what the Protestants were unable to get us to conform to by force during the 19th century, they've managed to get us to conform to by shame in the 20th century. They basically have shamed us out of our religion, so that the only thing we're proud of the 19th century Mormonism is the fact that the pioneers dragged their asses across the plains and didn't quite make it to San Francisco. And our heritage is being vitiated by people who are ashamed of either their brains and their genitals. So all we get is the sympathetic heart pumping and pumping and pumping like we're brain dead, and we're also sexually dead. We can't talk about these things. We're not allowed to explore these things. And if we do, we can sense ourselves being marginalized, not only by the leaders, but by extremely conservative members who are in complicity with them. And at the very moment we're trying to abandon these things, Dan Brown writes a book, and surprise, surprise, we find the American public ready to accept the things that we are ready to discard. And it's like, to me, some kind of a Kafkaesque nightmare that...
I would like to now go to a question that you raised in your last little statement, Paul, and that is that on the one hand, I'm not at all disturbed by the idea that Jesus had a child. And, you know, again, there's no historical evidence of it, but in terms of theology, it doesn't bother me. I think that you can still accept the divinity of Christ, which I do. I accept the divinity of Christ, and I think you can still have him having a child. However, the thing that worries me about that particular theology in terms of also what 19th century Mormons taught is that it seems like the dangerous side of that is the idea of a chosen race, and that somehow that you can be saved on the basis of your lineage rather than on the basis of faith or compassion or love, or what to me is the center of Christianity, is the idea that it's not on the basis of your tribe or your lineage, but on the basis of the inner transformation and being born again and so forth. And I see that as dangerous. On the other hand, you know, obviously in Mormonism there is this tribal element, and, you know, it does create a strong community. So I would like to know how the panel responds to that. I think this is a very important but difficult theological question, the whole idea of lineage and the dangers of that.
Yeah, I agree with you, Margaret. In the panel the other day with Margaret Starbird and Maxine, or maybe it was the evening session, I don't remember which one, but someone asked her what she thought about Jesus having a child, And for him it was problematic, but she didn't see why it would be. But I think this is the reason it would be problematic for some Mormons, because we have the teaching that the reason Jesus is divine is that because his literal father was divine. And that's, you know, that's what gave him his power. That's what made him the divine, the Son of God. Now, I happen to disagree with that teaching, and my ideas are based on the Book of Mormon, the teachings of Abinadi, where he says that Jesus was the Father because of the Spirit and the Son because of the flesh. In other words, according to this teaching in the Book of Mormon, Jesus was the Logos, the Word, the creator of the world. He was already God, and he became incarnated. He was the Son of God because of the flesh. So I don't have any problem with Jesus, the man, having children. But I think for this person, there was something in the very flesh of Jesus that made him perfect. Now, if that were true, then why didn't God just come down and have all of us? Then we all would have been perfect like Jesus. So I think there's this kind of magic idea there that, you know, by your lineage, which I think is very dangerous. Now, of course, we have the corresponding doctrine that we're all children of Christ through the Spirit, that when we are born again, when we accept him as our Savior, when we take his name upon us, when our hearts are changed, then we become his children. And that, to me, is a very important and spiritual doctrine. The other one, I think, the idea that we are special because of the tribe we're in or who our parents were, whatever, I think that leads to elitism, legalism, all kinds of problems.
Yeah, I agree. I think the moment that we see heritage as needing to be literally proved, and if we can somehow prove a connection anywhere, and again, we see this everywhere in society, you know, Daughters of the Utah Pioneer, Sons of the Daughters of the American Revolution, you know, wanting to prove, you know, this whole mess about the two lines coming down from Jefferson and all these things, this thing where we want to somehow prove a connection that makes us better. And I think the moment we step into that, we're denying the actual heritage that we all have. At the very, you know, I personally think there's a spark of the divine in our DNA, and that we can respond to that we all have, not only recognizing it in ourselves, but recognizing it in each other. And if we are in any way going towards somehow trying to prove a greater right or a greater connection in our blood anywhere, then we have turned away from that divine connection. And I know that we have a tendency to do that, but I want to fight that tendency. I want to teach my children to fight that tendency, and I've seen firsthand how devastating something like that can be. And we can joke around it all the time, but it really is a devastating human experience to be somehow either elevated or diminished because of a bloodline. And so the last thing in the world that I would think Christ would ever want to leave is some excuse for that, and run away from it at all costs.
St. Paul actually dealt with this question in Galatians when he was dealing with Jews who claimed to be the sons of Abraham. And he said to them, if you want to be the sons of Abraham through lineage, you must claim that right through Ishmael, because that is the child we know was the child of Abraham. Isaac was a miracle child, and we have no idea who the father of Isaac was. If you believe that you become the children of Abraham through Isaac, you must believe in the covenant between God and Abraham, because you're only saved by the covenant, not by birth, but by a kind of rebirth, not by the things of the flesh, but the things of the Spirit. And this idea that, you know, you can trace your lineage back to a Merovingian king or some other doughhead is the most insulting, mean-spirited, low kind of thing, argument that you can ever make. Because what you're basically saying is, we sweep away all merit,
We sweep away all achievement. We sweep away all the things that we've been able to achieve by the use of reason and faith, and we're going to base our goodness, our specialness, and our privilege, our claim to privilege over other people, because I was related to this bonehead back in time, whoever it might be. It's nonsensical, and it's the root of evil, this class system that we build upon this. And we have it. It's alive and well in Mormonism, and it's alive and well in Catholicism. It's alive and well in Judaism and in Islam. And it really has to be rooted out. But it can't be rooted out by force. It has to be rooted out by ridicule.
But Paul, how do you really feel about this?
We're already running out of time, and I want to give the audience a chance to respond, but I want to ask, and please try to keep it a little bit short, one last question, and then we're going to open up to the audience. For me, as somebody who has, you know, talked for so long about the importance of the divine feminine, whatever faults Dan Brown's book has, I'm thrilled that it's getting people to talk about this again. And I'm thrilled that Mormons are interested in this book, and I'm hoping that this makes them interested in the divine feminine. Do you think that this is part of the appeal of the book, or the major appeal, and do you think that we Mormons, that this will help us reclaim something of the divine feminine? You know, I mean, certainly nothing I wrote ever did, so maybe Dan Brown can. Do you see something afoot here, or should I give up my hope?
Brief, everybody.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's very, very encouraging that this book has been so popular. And I like you, I hope that it's partly because people are hungry and want to know more about the divine feminine, and that it's important that women are recognized and that they have a place of importance, and that they are in all ways equal to man. And so, yes, I find this very encouraging, and I really liked this book. I thought there were a lot of good things in it. If anything I said indicated otherwise, that is not so.
What I would like to see the book do is invite, just open up something about looking towards a sacred partnership. The thing that I would hope that people could see out of that is there is a way to come together in a partnership that has no end. So there's nowhere to get, there's nothing to actually complete. It goes on forever. It's never fulfilled, but it's always fulfilling. And I think that one of the best things about this novel is it suggests that there are role models for that. And not only role models, but the model for our life is that. And that we can find it in whatever sphere a relationship is in, that we can have that kind of a balanced partnership, that one is not over the other, but it's a union of amazing ability.
Well, I don't think that this book will lead Americans or others to believe in a Heavenly Mother. I'm not sure we really want a Heavenly Mother or a Heavenly Father. Some people do, but I'm not sure that's the best thing for us. But I think we want a Heavenly Lover. And I think this book kind of encourages a view of the Godhead that is more antique, that it goes back to what they've been calling the sacred marriage, and that is the idea that love between equals is probably a better deal than love between parents and children who are not equals.
Now I want to open it up to you, and we already have bunches of hands, so Alan, and if you want to come up here, I love playing talk show host, and we can get in the mic.
Well, Paul, I need to respond to something you said, and that is I blame the loss of sexuality as an emphasis in the church on St. Augustine. Well, at any rate, you know, early days of the Christian church, many of the competing cults, the Sibylline cults and the Isis cults and the Demeter cults, all believed in that sacred marriage. And it wasn't until St. Augustine really started preaching... Plato. I'm sorry. I'm a chemist.
Okay.
I mean, anyway.
It's your comment. Okay.
But anyway, let's just say the Neoplatonist ideas grew in. That was really abandoned in the church. And one of the things I think Joseph Smith restored was the concept that there is a duality in the Godhead in terms of male and female. I think we've lost that, and I think that's maybe this book is giving us some idea that that's something that's been lost, that we really ought to restore the restoration, if you will.
Do you think Lord behaved
in these places? I
doubt it. Other questions?
I'd just like to speak briefly about lineage. I have a little epithet here. Jody England Hansen has genes.
That was really nice.
And Nordstrom Rack.
I have a question for not only the panel but the audience here. Does anybody know a single written reference to Jesus being married and having children, non-Mormon reference, that is, before 1945? Any Merovingian, any Cathar, any Knights Templar, any Gospel of Philip, Thomas, Mary Magdalene, whatever. Anybody know of one? No, British Israel World Federation, which, by the way, B.H. Roberts and Talmadge were members of, they had no inkling of it, and neither did the Irish version of that same have any idea. But does anybody know one? I'd like to know it.
I'm not sure where he gets it, but Lawrence Gardner's book refers to that. I'm not sure exactly where he comes up with it, but he seems
in 1977. I mean,
they're in the 80s.
And his quote, he doesn't footnote where he says from the scrolls. Now I don't know if those scrolls are in the Vatican archive or the church office building or where those scrolls are, but he has scrolls. But that's not a reference. Where is anything written before 1945?
You mean before the Nag Hammadi came out?
No, I'm including Nag Hammadi. I'm including the 47 text from Nag Hammadi. The word companion does not mean spouse. It means sexual partner, consort. Okay, nothing about marriage and maybe nothing about children either. So I know of no reference, and I would really like to get one. I would really like to know where the Knights Templars came from. Not came from, the Priory to Zion. Any small reference that's in print that said, yeah, they were married, but can't say it until Joseph.
So you're just talking about the marriage. You're not talking about the idea of Jesus having offspring or...
No, I'm talking about a marriage and or offspring.
I know the grill legend, you can put that
before
that. But
there's no grill
that
legend that says that. I mean, you know, a wolf from
I've seen some things before 1945 that are Arthurian texts that talk about the knights being descendants of Jesus.
No, knights
that's
being descendants
not what you
of
mean.
Joseph of Arimathea.
No, I've seen the other.
No.
I'm just telling you what I've seen.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
No,
yeah. Did you have? Go ahead, though. Did
well,
you have
I like the book quite a bit, even though the characters are very flat. It's not great literature,
right,
as you've said. And in spite of some of the inaccuracies, John the Beloved being Mary in the Last Supper, besides the fact that he was always depicted that way, Da Vinci. Leonardo had sketches where he had names for the various apostles, and that apostle next to him is always listed as John. But my interest comes more in the mystery of the whole thing. And as a French teacher, I
have always been fascinated about how much reverence the French have for this Mary Magdalene character, and if the tradition was just an old tradition, you know, how do you get together the funds and the will to build all of these medieval cathedrals who are dedicated not to Mary, the mother of Jesus, but to Mary Magdalene. And I find my students have become interested in this over the last year, and they want to go over there, and they want to go over there and check it out. They want to go to Saint-Baume and her grotto where she supposedly grew her hair down to her ankles, and to Saint Maximum, and she was apparently even in Aix-en-Provence and other places where she might have preached. And so I'm going to go over there next month and check some of those places out, and then take a May-term trip next year with students. But I have to tell a Marquis Peterson anecdote, since it was alluded to his sexual... He does have sexual issues, or had sexual issues. When I was on my mission in Western France, he came for a huge zone conference, and the only thing that I can remember about his counsel to us was he said, "Elders and sisters, I don't want you looking at yourselves naked in the mirror, please." But I remember leaving the hall with one of my companions who said, "You know, I'm going straight home and I'm going to look at myself in the mirror."
I haven't read the Da Vinci Code, and I really don't care to. I read Albert Schweitzer's In Search of the Historical Jesus, and only the last page I can remember, he said it was a wonderful trip, but I'm no closer than I was when I started. But you mentioned that you need to find something that you connect to, something that you can relate to. I read Apocrypha, American Apocrypha, then I went ahead and read View of the Hebrews. This book here, OSPE, my grandfather read when I was 8 years old, and I heard about it in the family, and I often wondered about it. And I thought, well, it's probably too rare, you can't get it. But I went up here to Sam Weller, and they had a $30 copy. It's not very rare at all. You can pick it up and read it. But it kind of makes academic what the Da Vinci Code's saying. And this is wonderful. It's made me feel good. The Book of Mormon didn't make me feel good. The Quran made me feel terrible when I read that they have conditions under which they can beat their wives. And the Book of Science and Health by Mary Baker Eddy, that was fun. But this has really made me feel good. And what he says in there, and what I'd like to believe, is that Jehovah, which is how he refers to God, and according to this book, Jehovah had many sons, he had many daughters, and they were lords and gods that served on this planet and in Atmospheria and Etheria and Nirvana. But what he said was Jehovah's asexual. And that seems to ring true to me. If we're all created in the image of God, and like the leader of Metallica said, the Spirit's as big in you as it is in me, doesn't it seem reasonable that if we're all created equal, that God was asexual, or Jehovah? So, anyway. I want to have
fun reading a lot. Someone wanted to know the book title again. Sir? Okay. Jim, stand up, or you can come up, or you're Jim too. And that I wanted to say something. I'm a mystic.
I don't know. How many of you had somebody in the ward when you grew up who could trace their genealogy back to Adam? You know, I mean, one of the things that was disturbed me about the book, I want to see if it annoyed anybody else, but that is a political thing. You know, these genealogies were done by Otto von Freising. The Russians had one for Ivan the Terrible. Where you all connect yourself into the apostles or the Holy Family, and it's a way to legitimize your lording it over the peasants, And you know, the fact that Dan Brown would dig this stuff up about it and be serious about it, I found pretty disturbing. The other thing I found pretty disturbing, and nobody's mentioned this, is Sophie is kind of slow on the pickup in this book. I mean, this is supposed to be a book about the divine feminine, and the guys are telling her what to do all the time, and she's going, yeah, wow. Does this bother anybody but me?
Obviously, there were some back here that bothered. But I'm glad you reemphasized the problem with the lineage. I think that's important. The other Jim?
I didn't have my tag on it. My name is Jim. Some things that I've really adopted are things that keep me in awe every day. The ultimate mystery of being goes beyond all categories of thought. The best things can't be thought about because they transcend thought. The second best are the thoughts that are supposed to refer to that which can't be thought about, and one gets stuck with the thoughts. And the third best are what we talk about. And I always get tripped up on that. Talking about sexuality, I remember being in Liberty Park and slopping spit with my girlfriend one time, and people are looking at me, why don't, for God's sakes, go home and do that? And, you know, most of us are embarrassed when we see this. We go home and we watch pornography. So figure that out. We talked about the sexual experience, and this was another thought that I heard that I put to paper. I felt so much in love with it, and it's looked upon as the closest thing to unity, to divinity, is the one point of meditation, and that's the sexual experience. It's the closest that you'll get to the divine. And of course, after that, you know, you break out the smoke and you're laying there in bed, and you go back to pairs of opposites. But I do love this stuff, and I appreciate you guys being here. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to run out of time, so I want to at least get like four more in, okay?
Is anyone else troubled by the notion that wholeness has to always come in partnership? You know, I'm troubled. I don't know whether I really... Well, and there's that question, so I'll throw that to you. And then secondly is... I think one reason I'm troubled by it is because we talk about maleness and femaleness, and those words are so charged with in terms of tradition and stereotype and that sort of thing, that when we say female, what do we think of? When we say male, what do we think of? And there's a part of me as a feminist that just reacts to the use of the terms.
Yeah, rather than have panelists answer, I'm going to have more comments. Elizabeth? But we only have like 5 minutes left, Lori. But it's at the end of Sunstone, and the audience never got to talk enough.
Okay. Well, first off, I don't believe that Jesus invented any part of the female body. If anyone's responsible for that, it's our Heavenly Mother. And secondly, one thing that bothered me about Dan Brown's book was he was doing what, like, the Mormon Church has been doing. He was basically the feeling of the book was keeping this perfect male, a female divinity secret, as we have in the church been keeping our Heavenly Mother secret, and, you know, away from the foreground. And I just think that he was doing that too in his book.
Just a point of interest. In 1969, my husband Ogden Kraut wrote a book called Jesus Was Married, and I can't sit there any longer without at least mentioning that. What we did, as soon as that was bound, we took the first copy to Joseph Fielding Smith, who was then president of the Quorum of the Twelve. And we were able to get right in and give him a copy, and Ogden said, well, what do you think about that? And he said, absolutely, it's true. The account of his marriage is right in the New Testament, and that was referring to the marriage of Cana.